Joining us today is Dr. James Akinson, faculty member at Tennessee Tech University, where he teaches social studies and education courses, including a unique graduate course on country music for teachers. He's also a longtime leader with the Tennessee Council for the Social Studies and one of my colleagues. Great to have you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Yeah, glad to be here.
Appreciate you coming out, talking education. So I'm excited to talk to you to get some of your perspectives and just to have you on air. I've talked to lots of teachers and school superintendents and lunch supervisors, and I mean it's been a fun spectrum of educators.
I can imagine, and they know more than I do, but I'll give it a shot here.
they know, but you've had a lot of experience. So let's start with you. So tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got into teaching, how you ended up with 50 plus years at Tennessee Tech.
Well, 50 plus years is very simple. It's like the old gospel song, one day at a time. And after a while, it starts to add up. So I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm from the Midwest, but I do have bona fide country roots in that my grandparents farmed in southern Minnesota, 26 miles south of the Mayo Clinic, near Spring Valley, Minnesota. So I spent a lot of time on a farm, and it appeals to me in various ways and is part of me and maybe even contributed to my interest in country music, which is a component of my work in here at Tech and using social studies methods. Geography, history particularly is powerful when country music is used. And so I grew up in Minnesota, and then over a period of years went to the University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin, and I got smart and happened to meet my LP, life partner, Mickey, in Georgia. And she's from Mississippi, so I learned that winter didn't have to be a problem. And so I'm glad I'm at Tennessee Tech for all these years.
I imagine Mississippi weather is a little different than Minnesota.
A little bit. What they have in common is the Mississippi River, and mm-hmm. you can go to Hibbing or Bemidji, Minnesota, where Bob Dylan is from, and follow it all the way down through Memphis, all the way to Vicksburg, where my LP Mickey is from, and down to New Orleans, where Jimmy Driftwood fought the Battle of New Orleans in country music.
Mm-hmm. All the way down. So did you grow up? So you grew up working on a farm. Did you know you wanted to be a teacher always, or were you planning to run off to be something else?
Part of life is accidental, and you kind of stumble and bumble along in life, and so once I was done with my bachelor's in history at the University of Minnesota, which reminds me of the old joke, what is the shortest book in the world? And the answer is jobs for history majors. And so it crossed my mind, well, maybe teaching. And I got a master's of arts in teaching. And so you kind of stumble along a little bit at a time, and things have a way of working out, but it was right for me. It turned out that as I grew as a person, I grew as a teacher, hey, I made the right decision.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any family members, anyone in the family who taught?
No, the only person that taught was my Uncle Kurt, who was, I guess you said he's a teacher because he's a preacher.
Okay.
He was a Baptist minister, and that church was interesting because it was originally a very elite church in Minneapolis in the 1890s and gradually changed, and W.B. Riley was a leader in the anti-evolution crusade. And just recently we had, in Dayton, Tennessee, the 1925 anniversary of the Scopes trial. So W.B. Riley, the church, I never met him, but that church had a history, and it's connected to Dayton, Tennessee.
Huh. So, yeah, connected across the two across the two. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say a preacher and a teacher, because I think we've had a lot of students over the years who come through education and they either stick with it or they switch and they end up in the mm-hmm. ministry of some
That's
sort.
Very
because
common.
It is very similar.
It's particularly common in secondary education history majors. And I can think of two or three people who have gone on, and they have become ministers of the gospel. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a logical transition. And you say, well, I don't want to deal with high school age students. I'll preach on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a bad decision for them.
Yeah, not a bad gig. So being raised, so coming up in that area, I imagine you had lots of different influences, teachers in education, all the way from kindergarten through your university days. Is there a favorite teacher somewhere along the way that kind of stands out?
There are loads of teachers. I have very vivid memories of everybody from Miss Dillinger, who should have kept her cleavage more protected, to doctoral level faculty. But let's go with kindergarten through 12th. And my two candidates are Frank Engelbritt, my 11th grade U.S. history teacher, who I liked a great deal, and my 4th grade teacher, Miss Peterson, at Lake Harriet Elementary School in Minneapolis. And I'm going with Miss Peterson for two reasons. Number one, she always said, walk behind somebody. So when we walked into the room, if somebody was up front talking, then we made sure we walked behind them. Or if two people were talking in a place, you don't walk between them, you walk behind them. So that's number one, and I still quote that even here at Tech 60, 70 years later.
Yes. I have seen you do that.
Yes.
I have seen you do that.
So absolutely.
That's something that has stuck a long time.
So the power of teachers. And then the other thing is, in social studies, we studied Norway. And there were four Fs, fish, fur, fjords, and farms, which doesn't sound very profound, and I think probably doesn't really totally describe Norway today, but I remember it. And it's odd. Teachers have a power when they work with students and you remember things for years later, and mm-hmm. they do have an impact on your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, so typically my follow-up question is how did those teachers influence you? But I think you hit mm-hmm. the nail right on the head, that they've made a difference. Something has stuck. And I feel like a lot of people in the classrooms in education, they have those little pieces of their teachers live on, especially
correct.
The good
they're
ones.
They're really oddball kinds of things sometimes that you don't know will make an impact, be it content or the way you treated somebody. They'll remember that, and it will have an impact. And mm-hmm. The nice thing in teaching, I sometimes get Facebook posts from people I had 20 or 30 years ago, and they said, I want to tell you I'm using your things. So you may not get rich teaching, and you may not know all the times that you have influenced people, but they'll come out of the blue, and you'll say, well, this gig was worthwhile. That did make a difference for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially those, I think that a teacher spends so much time helping and working through that sometimes that they don't even realize the difference that they make or that spark that they light. I was never super excited about reading. I preferred Guinness World Records or something, you know, random but I had a teacher who, Miss Betty, she said, I'm gonna find books that you like. And so she introduced me to books that mm-hmm. I understood. My Side of the Mountain was one that just stuck out because it was about a kid who ran away from home, but he lived in the woods, mm-hmm. and he survived the winter, and it was interesting to me. I was like, oh,
Mountain Man.
There are things mm-hmm. that I can read in a book that are, you know, that I relate to, and it was such a good moment.
Well, she had an impact.
She did.
She had an impact because reading is. No matter what there is on social media, reading books is significant, and reading in depth changes you, and so she changed your life,
mm-hmm.
absolutely.
Yeah.
And you never know, and that's the thing. I remember President Roden one time at graduation had a famous Ohio State University reading professor, and he said, you need to make sure that you tell that person, tell that teacher that you made a difference. And then at that graduation then, one woman who I had in class came by and said, he told us to tell you that you made a difference. And she has gone on to make a difference because she's in Smith County and has been a brilliant teacher and now an administrator. So you just never know what little things you do have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
So with that impact, I know that you started in the K-12 world teaching. What made you, and I know I'm going back a few years, but what made you decide to make that jump from the K-12 world into higher education? Okay.
Good question. I think that I saw initially my brother, who was older, went on and got a PhD. He was totally brilliant and today is a world-class historian, literally world-class, nationally known. And then long-term, I thought, I want to do something like that. And I taught 4th, 5th, and 6th grade in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. For those of you who do drink alcohol, Point Beer is manufactured there, and it's kind of a craft local beer that has quite a reputation. But, yes, alcohol is dangerous.
Okay, so you made that jump. So let's take a short break, and then we'll come back, and I want to talk a little bit more about your years at Tennessee Tech and some things moving forward.
And we'll do it.
Welcome back. Talking to Dr. James Akinson, Dr. A, as those of us that know him affectionately call him. So we were talking a little bit about your getting to Tennessee Tech. So I know that your first year at Tennessee Tech was 1973.
Is that correct? Absolutely.
Okay. And so you have some perspective on that. So tell me, we were talking off air, tell me who you hired with, because I asked if it was Roden, but it goes back further.
It wasn't. I go back further. I interviewed with President Everett Derryberry, and at that time, he interviewed every candidate that came on campus. It ain't that way today, let me tell you, as you well know. And so I have a vivid memory of the walk around campus and going to President Derryberry's office and having that conversation. And Joe Sharp was the chair of elementary ed at that time. And I enjoyed the interview, and it seemed like a nice place. And he offered me the princely sum of $11,512. And how could I say no? Uh-huh. I couldn't say no. So, you know, it was the right decision, no question of it.
Sure. And that had to be intimidating, interviewing with the president.
Well, I didn't feel totally intimidated. I felt comfortable because I didn't know his reputation enough to be intimidated. Okay. And probably if I'd have been from Cookeville, I'd have been intimidated. But, you know, I didn't know him well. So he seemed like a very nice, a little bit austere, but very intelligent man. Mm-hmm. And it was very comfortable kind of 10, 15 minutes or so.
Okay. Yeah, and that obviously has changed a lot. And I don't think that President Oldham would have time if he wanted to have time today to work through.
He probably wouldn't, and I'm sure he would be a fun guy to interview with. But, yeah, Tennessee Tech is – everything has changed and nothing is different, because Tennessee Tech was terrific for what it was at its time, in its place, and it still is. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a little bit like if you – were to do a sports analogy, around 1950, Tech played University of Tennessee and lost like 66-0. 2 years ago or so, Tennessee Tech played UT and lost about the same score. But, and here's the interesting thing, if today's Tennessee Tech team could play the 1950 UT team, I bet Tennessee Tech would win. But everything changes, and Tech has always been wonderful for what it is in the context of time. And I just today sat in on a PhD defense, a wonderful, wonderful defense. And I maintain, and I've said it several times, even at the PhD level, our PhD program, we could compete with Power Five and above conferences. So tech is a remarkable value. I think the taxpayers are getting tremendous bang for their buck, as is the Putnam County school system, which is excellent for, and also Putnam County government and the city of Cookeville. None of them are perfect, mind you, but for what they are, they're all doing a terrific job.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you've seen so many things change. It's funny because that analogy makes sense, and so much has changed, but then again, so much hasn't. You know, there are things and traditions that are very similar. What's one of the biggest things just about Tennessee Tech in general? Because I do want to talk education specifically, but Tennessee Tech in general, that you think is different today?
Okay, the difference is that students and faculty are far more highly qualified and prepared than what they would have been in 1950 or even when I came in 1973. And if you look at our department, it's just amazing. Mm-hmm. We have people in our department and across the board who have not just state but national and even international reputations and impact, as well as being terrific in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So the quality has improved, but in context of 1950, 1973, tech was always good in its way, and I think people need to be proud of Tennessee Tech for what they're getting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and we've received a few awards where the value of the degree in the university itself is some of the top in the state. And so it's nice to see some acknowledgement externally of the value of the degree from Tennessee Tech. So in the classroom, so you've started teaching. I know you've taught social studies methods. Mm-hmm. For secondary majors
and for elementary
for many, many years. So how do you approach that? And I know how you approach that, but I want to hear. I want you to share how you approach that to make it interesting and engaging. Yeah. And
well, you use the word engagement, and that is the key of good teaching. You can only talk for so long, and even PhD candidates and adults can't be able to concentrate for more than 20 or 30 minutes. That's my brother even says that, and he's a world-class historian. So you have to engage people, whether you're going to tell them something, whether you're going to provide graphics, pictures of various sorts, or documents, or photographs, or music. I love using music. You have to deal with the big ideas. You have to cover material, but whether it's reading from a text or whatever, you've got to find ways to interact with your students and give them something to do. I used to say, put something in their grubby little paws, and now I'm much more delicate. I say student engagement is the notion of the day. But it is true. Student engagement is where it's at. And then I'd say combine it with modeling what's called culturally responsive teaching, where you show that regardless of, even if they look like you, they might come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, working backgrounds, various things. You've got to show that you care about and tie in, whether they look like you or they come from different racial and ethnic groups. So that response is crucial, that they know that you can care about them. And one of the simplest things is to use their name and get their name right. And your name, psychologically, even biochemical studies show that it means a lot. So if you use somebody's name in class, that's the simplest way to connect with them and let them know that you care.
Mm-hmm. And I know that that's a gift that you have, because mm-hmm. I know that if we talked about someone from your 1975 or 77 mm-hmm. class, there are still people that you could recall.
There's some of them I can recall.
Which is amazing to me that you're mm-hmm. able to, I mean, that is a gift.
Yeah. Thank you. It is. I think that my long-term memory is probably my strongest suit, and the ability to connect ideas that don't seem to be connected. Mm-hmm. I think that's what teachers need to do. Those two things, I don't think I'm learn new material. If we were in basic math or even American history together, I don't think I'd learn it any faster than the most average person. But long-term, I'd remember it.
And I know, and you mentioned country music, so I want to take a short break, and then when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about that integration.
We can do that.
Okay, welcome back. Talking to Dr. James Akinson from Tennessee Tech University. So we were talking a little bit about your classroom, and so I love to hear some of the engaging things. And for our listeners, there's so many people. You've had so many students in class over the years that there are little things that I know that they've picked up that have stayed true for many years. I know that one of the things that you've done maybe your whole career is integrate music, or specifically country music. How did that kind of evolve into such an important piece in your teaching?
Well, interesting question. And growing up, I always heard on Sunday morning, prior to when we went to church, Sunday school and church, mind you, at First Baptist, the Renfro Valley Gathering. And there was something about the Renfro Valley Gathering from Renfro Valley, Kentucky, that fascinated me. And then, as in high school and all, the folk revival, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and all those kinds of things were interesting. And I also, once in a while, would listen in secondary and college to the local country station a little bit. So it always was there a little bit in the background. And then finally, when we moved here, then it was around me more, mm-hmm. and I started to learn that there were some books and articles, scholarly books and art about country music. There's a lot to it. It's not just the simple musical form that people think it is. There's got a rich, complicated history, but that history and its current form fits into all sorts of things for language arts teachers, but particularly for social studies, for history, geography, civics, all economics. Country music fits beautifully as an example. And that, of course, blues, gospel, pop, rock, all could do it. But country music particularly has a tendency to mention specific things in ways that make it very useful for a teacher.
Mm-hmm. And you've found ways to integrate it, I think, across the board over many, many years in your classes.
Yes. And for example, I have a lesson, demonstration lesson that we've gone through this semester, and I go through every semester because I like it, that deals with Johnny Cash. And Johnny Cash has a song called One Piece at a Time. And so we go ahead and analyze that, but we plot Cookeville on a map of the U.S., Tennessee, and the South, and deal with regions, the concept of regions, which is a fundamental concept of geography. And then we plot the Midwest and the Upper Midwest. And then we plot where Kentucky is. And then we say that there's going to be a song that's going to tell you a story. And we listen to Johnny Cash's One Piece at a Time, and he moves from Kentucky to Detroit, let me say it correctly, Detroit City, Bobby Bear said. And then he worked on Cadillacs, and he longed for a Cadillac, okay? And so we deal with the ethical things, because he decided to steal from General Motors the pieces of the Cadillac one piece at a time, because it wouldn't cost him a dime. Mm-hmm. And then we also deal with the fact that industrialization, which is what studied off in fourth grade, you have two major concepts, interchangeability of parts and standardization. You couldn't steal the Cadillac unless the parts were standardized and put together. So throughout that, we have that lesson. And at the end, he has a 59, 50, 60, 61, 62, 63, and it goes on and on, mm-hmm. automobile. And we do analyze, is it right to steal from your employer? Why is stealing wrong? But what are the big concepts? Interchangeability of parts, standardization, and then migration, movement, which is one of the other two, another major theme of geography. He migrated from one region, the South, the Mid-South, to the Upper Midwest. And it was part of a very significant migration, out-migration of particularly at this time white Southerners, although African-American Southerners also out-migrated.
So, and all based on a song.
And based on a song.
And that's the interesting part to me, and I know that students have always appreciated that, especially when you start, because you mentioned making those connections. Before you make the connections, sometimes, you know, if you play the song first and you're like, well, I don't understand. I don't know. I don't understand where you're going. But then by the end, you pull it all together and it makes sense. And
that's what it's all about, letting them know where we're going. But it still might not. But each step, each lesson, a lesson should have a good introduction, a set intro, to use the language. And then the body of the lesson needs to engage step by step with academic vocabulary and a lot of actions for students to do, including reading when appropriate, and higher order thinking. And the higher order thinking comes naturally when you're cued into it, and the state of Tennessee wants to see it, the national organizations want to see it. It's very significant. And then we draw it to a conclusion and go over it one last time to make sure that the points were understood.
Mm-hmm. Have you experienced, because you're teaching students to be teachers, so have you experienced misunderstandings or historical things that students have just completely brought with them that's wrong? And you just have to address that.
That's an interesting question. Given the nature of the things that I do, the content, I provide the content so that there are fewer chances for students to say, well, gee whiz, I thought this happened instead. But once in a while it does. But the main time when you can get misunderstanding is over vocabulary terms, I think, and that they haven't heard certain terms. Mm-hmm. Just this past week, when I had somebody read in our introduction to education course, working on using names, being culturally responsive, the word visceral was in it, and I have the students read it, and the person said in writing it caused a visceral reaction, and the student didn't know the meaning of the word visceral, so we dealt with the fact it's gut-level, deep response, emotional kind of response. So those are more likely to happen given the structure of the course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people coming from, you know, such different backgrounds and different, and I had mentioned Nate Bargatze. He's a very funny comedian. He's a very clean comedian, which is kind of nice. It is rare, but he's very funny. He's very self-deprecating. And so he has a story where he talks about how he was a very poor history student and didn't really retain or understand any of it. And so anytime he watches a movie and finds out that it's historical, he's always surprised. He said he got to the end of Pearl Harbor and he was just as surprised as everyone on the island because he has no recollection. You know, he's never been engaged. He needed better
problem.
History teachers.
That's the problem. He wasn't engaged. And of course, one of the problems in history traditionally is, Napoleon said history is lies agreed upon, and Henry Ford said history is bunk, and then somebody said history is just one damn thing after another, and it can be too much covering just facts and dates. Now, do you need to know some facts? Absolutely. Do you need to know some dates? Yes. You need to know some content, context, develop the richness and the connections so that it makes sense. And more than likely, Nate Bargatze had somebody who just lectured and they took notes or they read and recite and never had the engagement to build the concepts. So just like one famous world leader went to Pearl Harbor a while back and didn't know anything about, he said, what's Pearl Harbor about? You know, so that probably that's what happened. Lots of facts, but no engagement to go with it.
And I think it's interesting to me, it's difficult once you're a generation away from an event, how much that, I'm sure there's a bar graph that shows, you know, how much you understand, because I'll even talk to someone about 9/11 but people who were born, you know, my own children that were born after that time, it's just not as real to them until they've had interaction and understanding of it.
It's ancient history to them. In fact, I happened to be looking at the class list and saw that a current freshman were born in 2004. So they didn't know 9/11. And Beloit College in Wisconsin used to, every year, put out for professors a list of events that their incoming freshmen never knew about. And so your life moves. If you haven't experienced it, it's going to be much harder to make sense of it. And I'm sure there are all sorts of people, students out there that, what do you mean 9/11? How come you're so upset about 9/11? And so that's one more thing to teach.
Yeah, and there's so many events. And I think it can be overwhelming just because there are so many things. But having good methods for teaching it and making it memorable and engaging, I think are very important. So, well, in our last few seconds, what's next? What's next for you in this next chapter?
The next chapter. Well, this afternoon at 3:00, I get to teach Intro to Ed. We're going to do a lot of neat stuff in cultural responsiveness. Friday, I'm going to be dealing with our social studies methods people, and then at the end of the semester, I'll retire, and we'll see what happens then. I'm hoping that there's something I can do with country music writing and maybe still be involved in the Tennessee Council for the Social Studies somewhat. We'll see. You never know. It bothers me to see the abuse and neglect of animals. Maybe I should volunteer a day a week at the animal shelter or something. I'm going to try to fill up the time in some positive ways.
Fill up the calendar. Well, that'll be good. Well, I appreciate you coming out and coming down and chatting with me today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah, thank you.